Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. We're at a biomedical symposium put on by the Medical Center of the Americas in El Paso. It's a regional and a little bit of national program looking at developments in medicine, developments in medical technology. And one of the guests at this meeting, the keynote speaker, is Professor Greg Kovacs. He's from Stanford University. And he's going to be talking at this meeting and a little bit today in our program on the whole area of medical technology and devices. Greg, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Before we get into, you know, medical technology, devices, electrical engineering, and all that good scientific technological stuff, how did you begin your career as a scientist engineer? What were the driving forces for you?
Well, I think for me, having two parents who were trained in medicine, living in a house where I was never pushed to do anything, but my father had a philosophy that if you wanted your kids to play violin, you did not send them to violin lessons. You simply left violins lying around the house. So I would have probably set them on fire. But he and my mother both encouraged exploration of all kinds, which did include setting a bunch of things on fire, but just generally supportive.
You had a chemistry set.
I did have a chemistry set, though quickly outgrew it, having discovered this thing called a library where there were books on how to make things catch fire and right. Colored flames and smoke. And so anyway, just what every kid was doing. And if you haven't read the book Uncle Tungsten, it's a pretty good book about a similar experience, though that not being unique either. Really, I would explore various things. My father was a physician but tinkered with electronics, so I naturally started playing with the same things. And then I remember distinctly being curious about anatomy, and I was a young fellow, and I wonder what's inside an animal's head. And I think my mother went out and got a pig head, and it was sitting on the table, kitchen table. And I'm like, okay, I'll find out. And I wasn't,
old were you?
I don't remember. I was young. I had no idea how to dissect anything. So I'm sort of making a big mess of this thing. And I thought it was interesting. You know, I couldn't tell you a single anatomical structure, but eyeballs are squishy.
The closest I come to that is in school when they gave us bullseyes, and then we had to cut it open, and then the aqueous humor comes all over the place.
Right.
God, that put me, I became a chemist.
I was reading about that, you know, that the one thing that didn't get thought of till really late in the game as people were doing anatomy of the eye was freeze it. You know, freeze it first, and then all that right. stuff doesn't squish. And there's countless accounts of early anatomists saying, well, you don't know what it looks like because it squishes when you cut it. And this was in the era when they had ice. They knew what ice was. And so anyway, so pig heads were a big part of my...
Okay, so that was a big part of your development.
It was memorable, but basically... my take is that many families these days, with all the pressure, beat the creativity out of their kids.
Oh.
And not driving them too hard, but saying yes when they want to explore something.
I think the percentage of families in this world that would give their kids a pig's head or a mouse head or anything, and then some sharp devices, I think it's not on. It's no longer. Anyway, so then you finally got to college. Where do you get your education?
I went to the University of British Columbia for my undergraduate, was able to do a pre-medical coursework mixed in with electrical engineering. Went to Berkeley for bioengineering mm-hmm. to do a master's degree, and then Stanford for my MD okay. and PhD in engineering.
So you got MD-PhD. It was an MD-PhD program, or were they two separate degrees in those days?
So the way there was a program for people in the life science PhDs, the MSTP, and there still is, Medical Scientist Training Program, kindly put together by NIH. My path was different in that for engineering, that was not a category you could just apply to together. So I independently applied. So
okay.
one after the other, med school first and the PhD program.
That's interesting because, I mean, it takes an awful lot of soul searching. Once you've gone through this process and you've got the MD, you know, and you know that then there's a career there and you're interested in it, to say, well, wait a minute, I think I want that research component too.
Well,
not a lot of people do that.
They were concurrent, though, so it's just a matter of independently applying. And there were, at Stanford, so many of the people were already engineers. A lot of people had PhDs in my med school class, very different kind
okay.
of culture. So it was very supportive. And the nice thing was you could walk across the street from the memorization, and in the early parts of med school, it's a lot of memorization, a lot of learning basic facts. Walk across the street to a lab, turn on an oscilloscope, and build a circuit, and it was right. very good therapy each one for the other. So I was very happy. I was a very happy
that's something I should tell the students, that, you know, the thinking of this, that it's a therapeutic exercise by itself, the other.
I mean, I think in medicine, because of the enormous amount of knowledge that you have to have in your head before you can be fairly proficient, the gratification's delayed. And the medical programs, notably at Stanford, which I've seen, but I'm sure elsewhere, have worked on that. So there's early clinical exposure. It's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
Engineering, I mean, while there may be no early circuit labs in most programs, there's no barrier. You're not going to harm anyone by wiring up a transistor and making some smoke. It's not a problem.
So anyway, then you sort of got this duality, or you've got the medical education and skill, and you've got also then the research orientation. You know how to design an experiment. You know what sort of systems to be looking for.
Certainly know how to try to do an experiment, yes.
Yeah, that's right. Well, with pig's heads in your background, I suspect that you've got a lot of talent in there. What did you begin to study? When you were an independent, you know, researcher with a medical background, what were the first things you thought of to be of interest to you?
Well, so as you know, there's trends in science and trends in education. And so when I was first hired, there was almost a gold rush in MEMS, microelectromechanical system sensors. So I worked more than a decade on that. You know, that was the one and only time I would write a textbook, which turns out to be quite an undertaking. I'd realized how much time it would take to write a book, I wouldn't have done it. But it was a good thing to do. So did that.
Did you use the book to teach at all?
I did.
Yes, exactly.
It's your course notes that graduate into bookhood. Did that for 10 or 15 years. And gradually realized that it was very hard to do that fundamental work, building the sensor tediously in the lab, and then continue to go down the road to apply it, which is more of a generalist endeavor. And also came to understand that one of the problems with the academic lifestyle is that tenure forces one to be very, very monochromatic. It forces one to be an ultra specialist, and you must be judged against your peers, and you have to be, you know, the best in this pack of N young people. And so the only way to be a generalist is to get tenure and then say, I'm done with that stuff. Now I'm going to do what I really came here to do. And so gradually, it wasn't as dramatic as that, but
it's an absolute truth.
Yeah, well,
I've been in this business 40 years almost, and you see that. I mean, just the number of people who are sort of getting through that first six, and then maybe 10 because it extends, and then begin to say, now what I really want to do.
Right. So the pattern I've seen among a lot of friends that I do highly respect, friends and colleagues, is they work really, really hard. And some of them figured out how to do it without working really, really hard, like playing golf with the president of the university. But other than that,
president doesn't play golf.
You work really, really hard. And I'm just kidding about that. You work really, really hard. And then they come out of that tenure process. And a lot of them, so when people get tenure, there seems to be this pulse of people noticing that the rest of their life isn't what they wanted. Some of them get divorced. Some of them leave. Academics. So it's amazing. You reach the summit and then decide you don't like climbing mountains. It's like, okay, well, that's a lot of time spent, typically 5, 6, 7 years.
I mean, it's fine if they actually recognize that and leave. It's when they recognize that and don't leave, that's when you get a crisis.
Right.
I believe that.
Right. So a lot of people go through some life change then. And a lot of people like myself open their apertures because now they don't have to be the ultra specialist in something.
Right.
So that's what I found happened to me. And you know, really it allowed, going back to why I got into all this in the first place, is applying science to medicine, to medical problems. And I think that's one of the things that we've lost sight of in some corners and we actively debate, is engineering, at least to people like me, is supposed to be applied science. And engineering schools have now opened up and hired physicists who work on nanotechnology and things that are very interesting but are miles away from any application, and so they really have engulfed some of applied physics.
It's a big debate, the degree to which people in universities in particular, because where you've got that freedom, tremendous freedom, to pick and choose the issues that you study.
Right.
And there's always this, you know, behind you say, it's rather like an Englishman wants to grow roses. You know, I'd love to grow roses. I can't in this environment very well, but I can concentrate on silicon, germanium, and tin. And people say, well, what's the utility of silicon, germanium, and tin? Well, you know, there are some, but it's just not in the forefront. And so people say, well, come on. You know, you've got this privilege. You've got the tenure. You've got money. You can go out and do anything. Why don't you focus more on the application? And I sometimes have a difficulty answering that question.
So one of the memorable moments for me as a young professor was, you know, getting to chair PhD exams in other departments. I remember doing one in chemistry. And I'm like, okay, this is really great. You know, I love the discipline of chemistry. It's an honor. I go over there. And this young man gives a very eloquent discourse on this amazing cascade of electron transport in these molecules. I'm trying to follow it. Yeah, I took organic chemistry, follow it, and realize it's a ton of work he's done. And his advisor is a Nobel laureate. And the panel in there is a very distinguished panel. And at the end, I say, this is wonderful work. I just want to ask one simple question because I'm not in the discipline. What's the purpose of this? And all of these gray-beard chemists turn around, including the Nobel laureate, and they look at me with this look of astonishment. And then the Nobel laureate says, there is no purpose. This is science. Like, holy smokes. You know, I'm an engineer, clearly in the wrong place. But it was interesting, and there is this purity of science that I really respect. But I think there is, to engineering students out there, almost a responsibility to be an engineer. And we are seeing in some areas sub-disciplines arise where even the majority of the faculty actually aren't bona fide engineers. Bioengineering is currently going through that phase where there's a lot of folks in the department giving degrees in engineering who are not engineers and who are, for example, molecular biologists and physicists, the predominant non-engineering disciplines. So it's interesting. I think an engineer should be able to make a product, for example, build something. So there's a lot of philosophical debate, and you seem
absolutely.
To be well-versed on that.
Well, I'm well-versed on it because I'm probably a little bit too far on one side, the famous ivory tower. I'd rather enjoy it. But, you know, we do actually have a few patents, but never.
Well, you said you were measuring conductivity of polymers. That sounds pretty applied.
That's one thing, right? Yeah. Just before we take a break, I noticed from your vita that you were part of a team that was investigating the pieces of the wreckage of the Shuttle Columbia.
Yes, that was a sad...
Just talk about that a little bit. What was the role that you had in that?
Sure. So when that occurred, we were all stunned. And you know, but I think NASA recognized that with Challenger, they were too stunned. And I think they didn't bring outside people. They closed it up and they really didn't do as thorough an investigation as might have been done, though I wasn't there. So I'm not criticizing anyway. So Columbia... We were shocked. I was asked by our center director, Scott Hubbard, would I be the investigation scientist? And I didn't really know what that meant, but said, yes, whatever you want. And so I went down to Florida, commuting back and forth for almost 6 months, where we reassembled the debris. And then there was a secondary investigation into the human issues that occurred,
right,
and the loss of life and how and why. But that took a long time. It was a very educational experience. I mean, very sobering. I mean, you can imagine being there working at midnight in this giant hangar filled with the wreckage of a spacecraft and, you know, being exposed to things like 7 burnt helmets, for example, in a row. Just the visuals were quite...
Wow. It's amazing that they recovered at all. At least from my perspective.
So about a third of the vehicle was recovered, if I recall. I mean, the facts have faded. The numbers have faded in my memory, but certainly the major points didn't. And some of the learnings from that were really important in general in life. And, you know, NASA had taken a very difficult role on of running these incredibly complex systems that were cutting edge. I mean, hypersonic and large amounts of energy and all that sort of thing, with very old technology at the base. I mean, there were germanium transistors in the electronics. I mean, we found stuff that, you know, burnt circuit boards would look at them and go, wow, that chip's from 1970, and they were still flying.
That's
so
interesting.
That's typical, though, in military and aerospace systems.
Well, if
they
it
have
functions,
a
I mean,
pedigree
keep it,
of,
yes.
But that leads me to this one learning, was where the system was too complex to model properly. They had this in-family belief system that if the curves were within the family, within the envelope of the previous missions, everything was fine.
Interesting.
And in-family turned out to be one of the problems, that you could have an in-family curve that had a funny little wiggle, and if, well, it was within the envelope, you wouldn't necessarily worry the wiggle, and the wiggle was, well, something hit the wing.
Yeah.
Right.
So did that, in fact, inaugurate a distinctive change in the philosophy?
Well, we certainly hope so, and you know, we don't – I don't know.
I'm not in
the trenches there, but that was certainly in the reporting that was done. There were many other learnings, but, you know, that one could have, for example, done better things to prevent loss of pressure in the cabin, that people could have taken precautions to prevent cranial damage and so on, better human protection things.
But at least at the end, there was, because of the investigation, which was more thorough than the Challenger, you think this was an appropriate expenditure of your time and the energy, and we've learned.
I was, despite the sadness of it, I was honored to be asked to participate. Right. I think we found out, we satisfactorily understood the cause. I think it was, a closure exercise for everybody, and I think NASA did learn a lot from it.
Great.
I think that a lot of that learning, had we not had a mishap of that magnitude, could have occurred through external oversight. And I think every organization needs external, serious external oversight by people who aren't thumbing their BlackBerries, but actually listening and thinking, not afraid to speak. And the organizations have to be willing to internalize and act on the guidance they're given. And I think that's a problem that, unfortunately, tragedy forced that on NASA, but it does cause a lot of reflection after the fact for me.
Amen. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Greg Kovacs, Professor of Electrical Engineering from Stanford, and we shall be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel.
I shall beam down at once, Mr. Scott. You have the con.
I'll pick up my medical tricorder and meet you in the transporter room.
Ah, the old tricorder. If you're a Star Trek fan, you know the ship's Dr. Bones used a remote control-looking device to scan and diagnose patients. Amazingly enough, 35 years later, the tricorder may have arrived on Earth. It's called the Scout, made by Scanadu. The company will allow a limited number of people to register and pay to use Scout as part of a study to ensure its accuracy.
Then the company will use the study to apply for FDA certification so that it can be sold as an over-the-counter consumer-grade diagnostic tool.
Scout is palm-sized and designed to work while pressed against a person's temple. In 10 seconds, it measures your vital signs with 99% accuracy.
In that time, it can read body temperature, heart and respiratory rate, systolic and diastolic blood pressure, blood oxygen saturation, stress level, and perform an electrocardiogram using nothing but optical sensors.
The readings are sent via Bluetooth to a smartphone where apps track and analyze the data. Scout uses a 32-bit processor based on Micrium, the same real-time operation system used on NASA's Mars Curiosity rover.
Scout was intended for NASA astronauts to monitor important health indices while in space. But now, this simple device could be a valuable tool for first responders and healthcare providers who need quick, accurate vital signs.
Scanadu could eventually add new features such as plug-in sensors to expand Scout's capabilities. Beam me up, Scotty!
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here with Professor Greg Kovacs from Stanford. And we are at a meeting where we're going to be talking about a lot of medical devices. We've learned about Greg's background, his interest in both science and medicine and engineering. So now, Greg, tell us a little bit about your whole emphasis on medical devices. Tell the audience what sort of medical devices you're interested in. They're not walking sticks, I know that.
No, there's always something to be done to improve the walking stick. My interest is really in getting the technology out to solve, of course, meaningful problems. In my case, we've tended to focus on cardiovascular medicine. But getting devices designed and deployed on a large scale. And I can't say that anyone is guaranteed such a thing, and only an arrogant person would assume they could. But I think with humility, we try to address problems that are meaningful. So high blood pressure, heart failure, pulmonary hypertension, things like that nature. So there's a large denominator of patients that you could address where with mindfulness to market forces that, the price point has to be right, there has to be a reimbursement path. And then, of course, to efficacy, we try to build things that could reach those people and improve their outcomes. And by saying that, I mean many things. One is their outcomes, and obviously in terms of health and wellness. We want people to be better. We can keep them out of hospital more. That would be a great thing. And with a public health system or a closed health system, you end up paying the total cost. So the less cost means better care for all. So that's a lift all, the tide lifting all boats kind of thing where you reduce overall healthcare costs and then you benefit all patients. We also are a very big believer in this idea of titrating care, and it's been a passion of mine for some time.
Titrating care.
So just a chemist will understand that.
Adjusting. People out there are listening.
Yeah. So the idea that you might see your physician on a basis of every 6 months or every year. And in that half-hour meeting, some decisions are made, like you need to take this drug or I'm going to adjust this drug. And if there's a problem, call, but otherwise we'll see you in 6 months or a year. So the sample rate, the interaction interval is too long. So we tend to do what I call open loop care, which is that we don't make intermediate measurements and say, gosh, you know, your blood thinner is too strong. The blood pressure medicine is causing you to flush. If it's bad enough, you call, but if it's too much but not symptomatic, you won't call. So we don't adjust medicine, and there's reasons for that. One is the costs of seeing people too frequently, the fact that pills are formulated in certain sizes, which I remember from medical school, the notional patient is a 70-kilogram male, which is maybe fine for me, but not fine for a 100-kilogram female or someone maybe of a different racial background. Right. So there are very large quantum steps in medications and many other factors, but basically closing that loop is to say, we're going to actually have a metric, a measurement of success, like what is the person's blood pressure, which we're trying to treat, over a long period of time, but sampled fast enough that you see the trends, and then dynamically adjust the treatment. Mm-hmm. Say, well, you need to reduce the drug by 10%. You need to exercise this much more. So these are the kind of things.
It's a more continual flow of information.
It's adjusting
just,
enough.
Not every 6 months,
so,
but yes.
Yeah, so my analogy is if you're driving the car down the freeway, you'd want to be touching the steering wheel more than every hour once. So you'd be in the ditch. So the idea is those little tiny adjustments actually get you to Albuquerque or wherever you're going.
On the other hand, though, you know fine well that these days our engineers around the world have got motor cars that can actually go wherever you want without you touching it. So presumably that's a goal in medicine too, that somehow you'll have a little indicator on your wrist or something that you're taking the pill and you yourself will be able to look at it without actually going to the doctor, and maybe that will go wirelessly to the doctor who can then wirelessly go back to the pharmacy and modify.
In principle, yes. I mean the self-navigating cars, given that we live in the same town as Google, I'm a little more reserved about the efficacy of that technology. It will come, but I'm not sure that I trust a computer to drive next to me on the freeway or parallel park for that matter, though. I'm sure there's engineers screaming
robotics. Somebody in Atlanta, Georgia, saw this recently on the news, a blind person that now has legally got a driver's license and can drive in Atlanta because of these cars.
Well.
I mean, it's on the horizon. Not a mirage.
I think the issue as an engineer, as you know, if you have a computer, any kind of computer, you're in the middle of something that says, need to update, or, sorry, I need to shut down. Please restart. And you call tech support, and they're in Bombay, and they say, you need to reinstall the operating system. You know, well, you can't do that in a car. No. So if your car shuts down, that's not appropriate.
My children hate this a new operating system. It turns out we're on a plan of the telephones that when there's a new operating system, it automatically gives me all the messages they're texting to people.
Right.
So for a day, I'm inundated with all these messages from my kids' friends, and I'm so tempted to read, but I don't.
But so that actually, you touched on actually something that is a serious issue, which is the brittleness of complex systems, that when we get to a point where we have a million lines of code controlling your car, it's very difficult to verify it for all conditions. And so as we would be with an operating system of the day, the community actually is debugging it. And so I don't want to turn my car over just yet to software, no matter what's demonstrated at the big research.
Yeah, it ought to be a pig's head to be investigated.
So back to in terms of titrating care, we really believe that there's a lot to be done there. And the other thing is with devices, and I don't believe everybody's got it right. I mean, we all obviously have our entitlement to opinions, but there are a lot of researchers who aren't market-facing at all. So they build things that nobody would use de facto, such as the watch-based technologies. There's a healthy debate about watches because if you actually talk to people 20 and under, they don't wear watches. And so the people who, you know, are coming into the age where they'll have the money and they'll follow trends and they're going to be the decision makers don't want the product from the get-go because they won't wear it. Now, maybe if you make it cool enough and functional enough, we're going to see with the first wave of a watch phones that have real features to them, if there's any uptake. But, you know, maybe a 70-year-old person would wear a watch. Maybe. And if it's big and clunky, but it measures something they need to measure, maybe they will. But there's a lot of assumptions made. Another one I've seen is we're going to make this super fancy Wi-Fi-enabled wireless gadget for heart monitoring. Yet the customer demographic, the patient demographic, is 70 to 90, and they don't have Wi-Fi. They can't go into the menus on an Android phone and figure it out. And so you have to send pre-configured systems to them.
And I remember a colleague of mine had some non-invasive technique for looking at the heart cardiogram device.
Sure.
But it meant going into a room that was basically a Faraday cage in the dark and then sliding underneath a magnet with about 24 liters of liquid helium.
That would be a squidness, superconducting quantum
And so, not invasive, but you've got to be lying flat, pushed under this magnet in the dark.
Right, that's an infrastructure issue there. But it is interesting how it's evolving and that pull from the consumer space, the wearable devices for health, fitness, weight management, sleep management, is very strong. And those companies would love to get into the more clinical applications because there's, I think, much bigger potential for them, monetization and for societal benefit. It's very tough, though, because what's happened is since this ability to build a wireless wearable device has been extant for 20 years, a lot of the early patents have expired, a lot of the things have been published, so there's a very high difficulty in protecting your company in terms of intellectual property. There's a lot of freedom to operate, which is great.
Yes.
But so what do companies do to monetize and protect their investment? They stovepipe the data. They focus on one narrow thing. So a lot of these companies make a beautiful little wrist thing or a strap, and you can't access the data, and they want to sell you web services because anyone can build the strap or the watch. So we're seeing a lot of funny business in the market. I think if you look from the perspective of a physician or a healthcare provider, you'd want all the devices to be open APIs, open data streams. You'd want software that was device agnostic. So you could say for this disease and this patient, I want to aggregate their weight, their heart rate, their activities, and these labs.
So that's a goal of the community.
And at the end of the day, you could see people doing exactly that, open source, open environment development, and there are lots of groups trying to do just that.
Tell me very briefly, you just got a minute left here. The whole concept of your clothing as the sensor.
Sure.
Right? I mean, are you interested in that? Are you dabbling in that? Just sort of prognosticate into the future.
So there's a very crude joke that I won't tell about that.
Oh, no,
but
please.
I would say that the one of the things that comes to mind with clothing and sensors is engineers are the last people you should ask about fashion and style. So and there's some that think they know what they're doing, and not generally true. So I think it's going to be tough to, just in a very pedestrian sense, take technology that's changing fast and style, fashion that's changing even faster, and harmonize them.
Yeah.
I think they will tend to be divergent. And
it'll only work for very specific job applications.
But I think one of the things that is really missed in our communication to the general public, which the engineers often know but don't want to admit, is that sensing without actually getting right on the skin snugly, firmly, with sometimes sticky electrodes is very hard. So the things you can sense in clothing aren't that different from what you can sense in a cell phone, which you're already carrying.
Okay.
Movement, temperature, and so on. If you want to get heart signals, you can make a stretchy cloth conductive thing, but the signals are a little sketchy. They're not very comparable to clinical grade. But they're
implants. Implants are going to be the ultimate.
I think when medicine is fully mature, we won't be putting metal into people. We won't be putting anything into people. We're going to be doing it all molecularly. I think that ultimately, when we understand molecular medicine and understand how to repair tissue at the level of biology, the right tools are biological and chemical ones. I don't believe that in 1,000 years we're going to be implanting metallic objects in humans. I really don't.
Well, we won't be around to see if you are correct.
No, and the point is always predict things you won't be around for, because then no one can hold you accountable, right?
Greg Kovacs, Professor of Electrical Engineering, Stanford. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much
for being here.
And we'd like to thank Norman Martinez for editing this and putting it all together. And we'd like to thank you, the audience, for listening. Without the audience, there's no program. Take care.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The region's first ever biomed symposium drew more than 350 people, more than double expectations. $9,000 was awarded to 12 participants in recognition of their research. Another $25,000 may be still awarded to a translational medicine project born out of biomed. Learn more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred Hospital, a transitional care hospital.